This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ed Pulford, one of the hosts of the channel. On the podcast today, we have Darren Byler, who's Assistant Professor of International Studies at Simon Fraser University, and he'll be talking about his new book, Terror Capitalism, Uyghur Dispossession and Masculinity in a Chinese City, which was published just a few weeks ago in 2022 by Duke University Press. Although now competing for global attention with a new cascade of awful international events, the situation in China's northwestern region of Xinjiang has not become any less urgent in recent months. And even if it has slipped off the front pages, one sliver of silver lining in the ongoing crisis there over the past few years has been that many more people are now more aware than they once were of where this place is and of who its Uyghur and other Muslim inhabitants are. Perhaps perversely, then, the system of camps and other repressive state measures intended to liquidate much of Uyghur identity has encouraged better understanding of the history and makeup of the region, brought to us by a range of impressive scholars and reporters. But one thing that's often been missing from the conversation is a granular and in-depth sense of how the regime of unfreedom, or enclosure, as the author of this book puts it, mushroomed into existence in the Uyghur region during the 2010s. As a result, Darren Byler's Terror Capitalism is a vital addition to our understanding of this emergency. Based on long-term fieldwork in Urumqi and other locations, Byler's book is a chilling and deeply moving portrait of processes of colonization and re-education whose advance has intensified since the 2014 onset of what the Chinese government calls the People's War on Terror. Marrying ethnographic attention to detail with piercing insight into grand techno-colonial processes carried out by a confounding array of agents, Byler is able both to offer an encompassing theory of the statist and corporate forces which have brought this situation about, and to demonstrate its horrifying, wrenching effects on his mostly male Uyghur friends and interlocutors. Emerging clearly from the pages of the book are voices of aspirational rural to urban migrants, apprentice bakers, social media entrepreneurs, religious devotees, friends, artists, and above all, ordinary people facing an unassailable edifice of state violence and imprisonment, whose terror often seems to exceed any words one might reach for to describe it. But in our effort to get to grips with this situation and find some words to talk about it, I'm glad to say Darren Byler is here with us now. So I'll say welcome, Darren, to the podcast.
Well, thanks so much. It's an honor to be here.
Great to have you on as someone who I'm sure many interested in the situation are already very familiar with. Perhaps I'll begin by asking you, though, as we usually do, about your own background and how you became interested in the Uyghur region and what's been happening there.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a long story, so I'll give you the shorter version. I went to the Uyghur region for the first time when I was an undergraduate student at Kent State University, which is in Ohio, which is where I'm from. I was studying photojournalism at the time and was doing an internship with a human rights organization. And it gave me a chance to sort of explore Asia. I didn't know Chinese. I didn't really know much about the region. I was mostly interested in taking pictures. But I was really struck by the society I found in Northwest China. As a photographer, the sort of the street landscapes, the market culture of Uyghur bazaars was just a vibrant thing to look at. And I could see that, as I over time continue to think about this place, that it was changing quickly, that there's a lot of development happening, Chinese construction companies moving into the southern part of the region, which is the Uyghur majority area. And so things are really changing fast. And the sort of intact or living culture of Uyghur society, where it was a Uyghur world, everyone speaking Uyghur, everyone, living in a space that they claimed as their own, where there was a lot of autonomy. I could see that was being challenged and changed. It was a fragile space. And so I thought it'd be an exciting thing to study, which, took me to do PhD work at the University of Washington, where they had a Uyghur language program, and an advisor, Sasha Suling Welland, who was doing work on feminist art in China, in Beijing. I thought, one of the things I could study that wasn't too sensitive, because already back then Xinjiang was a sensitive topic, would be art production and knowledge production that Uyghurs were doing, a lot of it online. That's what I embarked on, is a PhD project that would look at art, would look at how Uyghurs and Han artists in this space were working together to represent what was happening to them, the development, the processes of dispossession, and how they were building a kind of grassroots politics that would resist some of that. Over time, I saw the digital technology that was offering that space to these artists be used as a tool of surveillance. And I also saw the space for solidarity work of, any kind of politics of resistance really be diminished, subtracted, taken away from these people. The circumstances on the ground sort of shifted the project to look more at state violence and less at the potentials of art.
Right. Well, there are some, residues, if that's the right word, or artifacts of that earlier period of research in this book too. Given that what you're dealing with is such a moving target and I think the particular anthropological focus you have on the immediate present and on very granular events makes this all the more remarkable work in many ways, because when things are changing so quickly, where do you put a stopper on? How do you represent that? How do you sort of bring it into some written form where a book is produced that is static and sort of, says something about a situation which changes even as, after the book appears? So I think it's a tremendous piece of work, both, given your changing focus and the shifting targets of what you're discussing. And we'll be getting into a lot more of that. How about the book itself? Is it, it's a drawing on your doctoral work, or how did it kind of come about? How does it relate to the work that you carried out as a graduate student?
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of it is based on my research as a doctoral student. I went to Xinjiang to, really get my language foundation sort of up to where it needed to be to do research in 2011, which was 2 years after there was large-scale violence in Urumqi in 2009. And so already at that point, there was a lot of police presence. There was a lot of securitization. But you know, the urban planners of Urumqi, the capital, were building an art district in the northern part of the city. And so I spent a lot of time there with mostly Han artists who were interested in representing what was happening to them. A lot of those folks were old Xinjiang people, and that's how they talked about themselves. There were people that had grown up in Xinjiang as part of the Bingtuan, which is the People's Construction and Production Corps, farmer militia group that was sent to Northwest China, and you know, beginning already in the 1950s. Those people identified as Xinjiang people, and they saw what was happening now with a lot of economic development and new migration from other parts of China as really leaving them behind in some ways. And also they were quite cognizant of how it was affecting Uyghur society. And so that space seemed to offer a site of critique of the system. And it was also an accessible space for me as a researcher to access. So in 2014 and 15, I went back and did another year and spent more time with those artists. But I was also then starting to work with Uyghurs. My Uyghur language was up to where it should be by then. And I was living in a part of the city in the southern part where, you know, it was mostly around me Uyghur migrants. And so I was interested in how Uyghurs were representing themselves. And I was associated with an institute that had a number of media artists as part of the training that was happening at that institute. I was interested in how they were using WeChat to build these salons of literature and film, Uyghur film that they would, you know, post online, and then, you know, within the space of a week or two, 800,000 people across the Uyghur region would watch their films. And so it was like really significant kind of cultural production that was happening. But, you know, as I was hanging out with these people, they were telling me about how the police were coming into their homes, how they would, you know, check under their beds and in their closets for any unregistered people. And the police were doing that in my apartment as well. They were creating digital files for everyone. They had instituted a new passbook system called the Bianmin Ka, which is the convenient for the people card, which is basically a good citizen card that is specific to Xinjiang that people from rural areas have to get in order to leave their home county. And so it was forcing hundreds of thousands of Uyghurs in the city to leave, go back to their villages. And so that card and the police inspections became an important part of the story of, like, you know, how do you live despite really, really intensifying surveillance? And then, you know, when I went back for the last time in 2018, I saw that many of the people I had interviewed and the spaces I had inhabited before were now completely changed. And, you know, so many people had disappeared into this camp system. And I was learning about all of the different modes of digital surveillance that were being used at that point, which was, you know, scanning people's phones, biometric surveillance. I went through, you know, lots and lots of checkpoints during that visit to observe how the checkpoint system worked. And so basically I saw over time this space be overwhelmed by surveillance and technology, and how technology that seemed to promise something better for Uyghurs was now used as a tool to, you know, radically restrict and assess them, control them.
Yeah, well, perhaps we will get onto that in a bit more detail in due course, because it's such a key dimension of the overall process and what makes it such a distinctive, I guess, 21st century phenomenon in many ways. But yeah, we'll jump then into the kind of framing, I guess, overall of the project and the book and how it sort of, you know, emerges terminologically, really, in your analysis, because I think this is key to our understanding. And if in beginning with terms and with, you know, theory, if you like, I think we approach head on some of the many difficulties which emerge in discussions of this issue, because, you know, certainly in cross-border discussions of this issue, the application of various key terminology to the situation ends up creating, you know, its own friction. So we'll begin with a topic you deal with in the preface to the book, and then also at greater length in the introduction. And this idea of capitalism as a framing. The first chapter is called, or the introduction is called, "What is Terror Capitalism?" So I guess I'll start by asking that kind of general open-ended question. Capitalism, it's something a lot of people are talking about. We've been hearing a lot about it. What is it that makes this project, most germanely framed in terms of capitalism?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's one way into the project. There's other ways of framing it. But I felt like it was an important way of approaching this situation, because it's, you know, what I observed during my fieldwork. It's me making sense of what I observed, how surveillance technology can become a growth industry, and how terrorism as a category can produce a population of people that stand outside of the law or outside of civil protections, and can be treated with sort of impunity. And as a site of investment as well. Terror capitalism is a frontier of global capitalism, is how I'm thinking about it. It's similar to other new kinds of capitalisms. There's a proliferation of these terms, like surveillance capitalism, disaster capitalism. And it's also related to an older framing of capitalist frontier making, which is racialized capitalism or racial capital. So how does it fit into those things? Terror, if we think about terror as like a disaster, or a terror event as a disaster kind of event, and as counterterrorism as a way of preventing it, we see how it becomes a site of investment for the tech industry, and a way of accruing data. Terror capitalism, as in terms of the way it's productive, is really in two senses. First, it's, you know, in the way that these tech companies, there's, you know, 1400 tech firms now working in Xinjiang. Initially they were focused on breaking the autonomy of the Uyghur internet, you know, because Uyghurs are using Uyghur language. But then it became more about control. And these firms are receiving state capital in the tune of, you know, at least $10 billion US dollars, over $100 billion when we think about infrastructure more generally that's been invested since 2017 in the region. And so they're getting capital, right? Then they're also getting access to state data, which is really important for tech firms, especially in artificial intelligence, to develop new technologies, new prediction products. And over time, they're also, you know, the system is producing a new kind of laborer, an unfree worker who's being placed in factories associated with the camps, or even in addition to the camps. And so it's producing this way of extracting labor from Uyghurs and Kazakhs and others who were not industrial workers prior to this. So, you know, that's how it really becomes a capitalist system. It also, of course, has a political aspect to it. It's producing docile, subservient citizens. And so it's, you know, enacting or producing a solution to what the state would call the Xinjiang problem, which is that Uyghurs and Kazakhs are, you know, not fully assimilated and resistant to the state. This system is meant to sort of break them and turn them. But I do want to also add one last thing, which is that the terror aspect of this is building on the discourse that comes out of the global war on terror, which, you know, posits that Muslims, particularly Muslim men of military age, are potential terrorists, like kind of in general, that they're always already potential terrorists. And so it has a racializing effect, which is how we should think about this as related to racialized capitalism. So because Uyghurs are, you know, placed in this category of always suspicious, they are subject to continual assessment, based on assessments of their digital history, they at times can be deemed untrustworthy for these low-level terrorism crimes, sent to the camps and put into the factories. So, you know, that's how I'm thinking about terror as related to a racialization of an ethnic difference.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, that's actually a very good link onto the next question I had, which is specifically related to this ethno-racial dynamic, as you very, I should say, adeptly kind of outline it. But obviously, when it comes to terms like this, when it comes to terms like colonialism as well, which is, you know, one which, of course, is absolutely inadmissible under any circumstances within the context that this is occurring, you know, inside China, there are certain hazards and pitfalls as well as certain benefits from, you know, using terms which apply kind of to, you know, perhaps Euro-American geographies, Euro-American cultural contexts, or Western, if we can use that too. How do you see the significance of the kind of non-Western setting and the use of these terms in this context as a sort of contribution, you know, that as part of your overall sort of framing of these topics in the abstract?
Mm-hmm. Well, when it comes to colonialism, I think we have to think about it as related to capitalism. So, you know, colonialism, capitalism have, you know, throughout time, through the history of capitalism, been interlinked. They are, you know, they co-construct each other, with colonialism acting as a kind of frontier space for capitalism. Sometimes, you know, colonialism starts with capitalism, you know, with, you know, companies like the Hudson Bay Company going to places like Canada, where I'm at now, and then over time bringing with them, you know, a military civil administration to protect sort of the economic assets that have been built. So it sometimes works in that way. In the Xinjiang case, you know, it's emerging out of a kind of out of an anti-imperialism, anti-colonialism. So, you know, the PRC was founded as anti-colonial, Western European imperialism. And so it's, you know, about national liberation is how the state framed this. And there is some liberatory aspects to the founding of the PRC, in the same way that there were some liberatory aspects to the founding of the Soviet Union. But it also brought with it, you know, increased control and occupation of non-Muslim people, of non-native people to this space. And that was the Bingtuan people that I've already mentioned. But also kind of the capture over time of the grassroots institutions. The liberatory aspects of these is that they preserved the language and they allowed Uyghur culture to continue. They were just sort of, you know, adapting it or indigenizing it into a socialist kind of framing. That starts to shift from a kind of settler socialism, which I think is how we should think about the Maoist period, to a settler capitalism and colonialism in the 1990s, which is when the state begins to send large numbers of Han people from other parts of China to the Uyghur majority areas and, you know, begin to capture the institutions in a new way. And so, you know, capturing institutions is where you see colonial dynamics happening. So once the banking system, the education system, the mosque, you know, once those spaces are controlled by the state in this new way, and once there's a shift from Uyghur language and sort of Uyghur authority to Han authority in those spaces, that's when we start to see colonialism. And we also start to see a response from Uyghurs, you know, protest. Often the things that the state began to characterize as terrorism post-2001, you know, those things were a response to local injustice, police brutality and things like that. But, you know, it did also eventually call into existence things that we could count as terrorism that meet international definitions of terrorism, like the incident in Kunming in 2014, which is what sparked the People's War on Terror. I guess what I'm sketching out here is a way that, you know, colonialism developed in the same way that China sort of began to include elements of the global economy in its national economy, and also it's responding to its older period of imperialism and colonialism. It's responding to a kind of moral wound of being a former colonized or semi-colonized space and now wanting to claim itself as a global leader and, you know, thinking, you know, to sort of posit and in equality with other global nations, you know, it can act as a colonial power. So it's building on sort of nested systems of imperialism to produce one in the present. When it comes to racialization, I mean, you see it in the way that the tech companies are reading the skin of the Uyghurs. They're looking at the phenotypes of their faces, and they're building directly on police technology that's coming from the West, which is also, you know, racialized in many cases. So as the institutions become so majoritarian, they begin to exclude the targeted groups of people, and they're using, you know, ethno-racial difference in terms of like how people appear and also their language as a way of sort of predetermining how people should be treated. And so that's how it becomes a kind of racialization.
Right. Yeah. And that's very convincingly argued in the book itself, the parallels, the very legitimate comparisons with processes that we might observe in a whole host of other places, of course. But you do a very good job too of highlighting the specificity. You've alluded there to this Mao period, the socialist era, the high socialist era, perhaps you might call it that, or as you've said in the Xinjiang case, the settler socialist era, and how Maoist multiculturalism and the particular taxonomies and classifications of Uyghurs and other non-Han groups during that period may feed into contemporary processes. One other specificity that I guess you draw out, and a terminological question that you are careful and justifiably, I think, careful with, is use of indigenous as a kind of counterpoint to the settler people, or rather, I should say, non-use, because you draw attention to this. Well, oddly, I guess indigenous or emic category, yerlik, a Uyghur term, which you translate as native. Could you say some more about the particular construction or conceptualization of localness or of belonging, of deeper belonging to the region that stands in contrast to the settler colonial processes that you describe?
Mm-hmm. Right. So I was really struck by the way I would see Uyghur migrants to the city bring products or things with them from their villages, and sell them, you know, in the bazaars or on the street. And they would often have like these hand lettered signs, you know, written in marker that said yerlik in Uyghur language, and, you know, yerlik honey or yerlik, you know, whatever they were selling. And yerlik means of the land or of a place, you know, in a literal translation. But it also means native. It's by, you know, definition halal because it's produced by Uyghurs. And it's rooted in place. And, you know, Uyghurs also sometimes talk about their family graves as the yerlik, where they are from, like that, you know, it's that, you know, closely tied to the land. So, you know, for me, that was them claiming and enunciating, you know, on the sign that they are a particular kind of identity, that they are indigenous in some way. Though because the discourse around indigeneity and colonization is so tightly controlled by the state, and, you know, people don't have access to sort of, you know, internationalist movements of decolonization in their daily discourse. It was them sort of, you know, developing a term on their own. So I wanted to think about that term, yerlik, and what kind of knowledge is being claimed, how traditions are brought into the future, into the present, through the knowledge that people learn in a local setting. And how it forms a kind of collective identity, across space. Like, people have different kind of yerlik traditions depending on where they're from, but they all see themselves as yerlik. I wanted to really pay attention to that, and you know, I treat that as them saying that they're native. At the same time, you know, there's intellectuals in the Uyghur community, both in the region and more so in diaspora, who are resistant to the term indigenous because they see it as a backwardness, as a primitiveness, which is how the Chinese state also talks about indigeneity. There's a discourse of modernization and of, you know, bringing civilization to the Uyghurs that, you know, Uyghurs at least, you know, some have internalized. And so there's an antipathy towards the framing of themselves as indigenous. Instead, they want to say, no, we're modern. We want to have our own state. And here I'm speaking about people in diaspora. And so I wanted to be careful in talking about indigeneity and be clear that I'm referring to the way that, you know, I observed farmers, migrants talking about themselves and claiming it from that position. So I wanted to say that they're approximate to other indigenous groups and how they claim their indigeneity. But, you know, it's a contested term. So it helps me to think with settler colonial theory and also decolonization and critical indigenous studies and to situate Uyghurs within that scholarship and that discourse.
Right. And to, I guess, find a place in what is often a challenging situation where in order to engage with decolonial thinking, whilst also doing justice to local context, you want to avoid importing paradigms from elsewhere, because that reproduces a strange kind of, I guess, epistemological colonial, way of conceptualizing things. So I think it does that work very well. And then finally, I mean, in our fairly already, I guess, in-depth discussion of this, of the setup of the whole book, but the one other term, I guess, that I wanted to come to, which is there, of course, in the title, is masculinity and gendering dynamics as part of this colonial capitalist process. So could you say something about how gendering dynamics interact with racializing ones, and how that emerges kind of, or how it emerged in your own work, you know, how it sort of, I guess, was part of your own subjectivity in the field?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what you just said is exactly part of the reason why I was moved in that direction. It's, you know, I'm speaking from my own positionality as a male anthropologist, and following sort of local and, you know, Uyghur traditions of, like, you know, what is appropriate sort of relationship building. And also, you know, because of sort of patriarchal traditions in Uyghur society, the majority of migrants to the city were men, young men who were sent by their families to make money for a few years, send it back to their families, you know, as they sort of wait for marriage. And so it was all these single men who were coming to the city, often in groups of friends from, you know, the villages that they were from. And so that's, you know, those were the people I was encountering and really starting to build relationships with. And relationships are really important because of the sensitivity of what's happening and, not being able to, not being sure if you can trust people or not. And so you really do have to build rapport with people before you can, you know, actually get to sort of the truth of their life experience and all of that. And so, you know, that's how I started with thinking about men as a group of people, and, you know, how it relates to the larger dynamics. So one of the ways that the state frames what they're doing is that they're saving Uyghur women from Uyghur men, because Uyghur men are inherently dangerous as potential terrorists, and they are seen as the force that's been radicalizing women as well, forcing women to veil and so on. And so there's a kind of false feminism or, you know, imperialist feminism that the state is projecting onto Uyghur women, saving Uyghur women, which is, you know, building on other kinds of militarized feminism that the, you know, U.S., you know, military or others have used to, you know, justify invasions of places like Afghanistan, to save the women. So you know, that's part of the story here too. And there is real, you know, domestic violence towards Uyghur women that happens, you know, that happens in all societies. There may be more of it in Uyghur society than in some others. But I think we can think about that as also a response of Uyghur men to the powerlessness that they experience, the sort of stresses that they experience because of the ways that they're blocked in terms of finding work, in providing for their families. Not that I'm going to blame, you know, patriarchal and misogynist traditions, fully on the Chinese state, but it exacerbates it, is what I'm saying. So, you know, those are the dynamics that I was looking at. I was primarily interested in sort of the positive aspects of Uyghur masculinity and how they, you know, pushes people to build friendships and to protect each other, which is, you know, something I focus on in the second half of the book.
Yeah, we'll move on to that in due course, I think. But that's very, very helpful to see how that sort of process is nested in, or the gendering process is nested within, I guess, the broader contours of what we've just been discussing. But yes, with that kind of overall, I guess, framing kind of established, I wonder if we'll move now into the first sort of part of the book, which comprises these first three chapters, enclosure, devaluation, and dispossession. All the chapters have these kind of extremely resonant and I think pithy titles, which you know, together create a very sort of forceful impression of what's going on in the most economical terms possible. In the first chapter, you, I guess, give us a fuller picture of what you've already alluded to, this sort of vast sort of technological edifice built up over time, involving both state and non-state actors. And whilst, of course, your main focus is the, you know, Yerlik, if you like, or the Uyghur life within the Uyghur region, there is perhaps a little more to say about the kind of processes from the outside perspective, or at least how different actors are involved in it. So, I mean, whilst recognizing that what you, as you say about the book, is a representation of Uyghur life under colonization, is your kind of encapsulation of it later on in the book, what can we say about the role that state and non-state actors play in this process of enclosure? How to understand the, I don't know, complicity, if that's the right word, or the contribution of individual settlers or workers for the tech companies that are involved in these processes? How do we disentangle, I suppose, the role of the state versus para-state or non-state actors in this overall dynamic?
Mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, I've really privileged or foregrounded the non-state actors in this book, or the corporate state actors. Private public partnerships is how a lot of this is run. But there is, you know, another story to tell, a biography to or series of them to, you know, talk about, you know, how Xi Jinping and Chen Chuanguo and other key leaders made the decisions that they made and mobilized, you know, policy and state capital in certain directions. But, you know, for me, I was, you know, really thinking when I was talking about digital enclosure about the technology companies like, you know, Tencent, you know, which owns WeChat, and all of the surveillance companies like Hikvision and Dahua, and the, you know, those that are building the algorithms, SenseTime and Mugvi and others, who are receiving, you know, millions, hundreds of millions of dollars, and are using that to rapidly prototype new technologies in this space. So it becomes a kind of incubator space for these technologists to rapidly develop new tech. Often, you know, I draw on the work of David Yang, who's an economist at Harvard, who talks about how within 2 years, many of these startup companies would develop a commercial application out of, you know, the sort of state investment that they had received. So there's a direct sort of, you know, military or policing work to marketplace sort of dynamic that's in place here. There's also, of course, the low-level police, the sort of police assistants who do a lot of the manual work of implementing the system. The state hired around 60,000 of those people and another 30,000 more, like regular police, to implement the checkpoints and also, you know, do the work that's necessary in the camps and so on. And then there's another million or so volunteers who are also not really state workers exactly. They're you know, company employees who are drafted or forced to volunteer to be sort of human surveillance people in Uyghur villages and Kazakh villages. And so that, you know, it's a whole of society war on terror. That's what the people in the People's War on Terror means. And, you know, everyone is asked to play a role. Play a part. And some people are benefiting more than others. Some people have more coercion than others. It's sort of, you know, a giant crime that's hard to pinpoint as at any one person because it's just so systemic. And also people that are working within the system don't really understand how the whole system works. They just know about their task that's right in front of them. And the technology also aids in that system. So you're just looking at an interface on a phone and it's saying this person is untrustworthy and you don't know. The system says that it's true. So you know, human agency is limited by the tech itself. So, you know, that's how the system works. And that's what I wanted to show. It's less about, you know, finding out who's truly to blame for the system and more about showing the dynamics of the system, how banal it is, and how sweeping and systematic it is.
Right. And it's exactly in a way that banality that makes it so effective, I suppose, these sort of apparently agentless tendrils of both capital just flowing around as it is given to do and technology, the flows of data and information that seem, if not autonomous on their own, you know, to be just sort of a kind of almost a like a liquid that everyone is just swimming in without, you know, or bobbing around in without any individual person being the sort of architect of the entire thing. In a way, I think that's what makes this analysis so convincing of why it's so powerful, why it's something that is so distinctive and irresistible in this context. But moving on to, I guess, the more subjective experiences of that, these first three chapters deal in some detail and some real rich ethnographic detail with the experience of migrants to the city, their engagement with technologies that you've already mentioned, social media and so on, and the kind of, I guess, brief honeymoon of autonomy and creativity that encouraged, and also efforts by rural to urban migrants in Urumqi to build sort of lives and careers for themselves and sort of accrue social capital and make something out of their lives. So could you kind of give us a broader portrait of the kind of migrant experiences that you wanted to foreground here? I mean, I think it's your call. If you want to say more about the social media use that you already alluded to and the changes in that over time, or the kind of ways that people are, you know, aspiring to a certain form of perhaps urban Uyghur existence that is devalued, what were you sort of trying to bring out most about those experiences?
Mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, the second chapter, which is about evaluation or devaluation, was me, you know, I wanted that sort of towards the front of the book because I wanted people to have an understanding of how different kinds of labor, different kinds of bodies are evaluated differently by this system, you know, both, you know, the political and technical system. And so, you know, Xinjiang is one space where Han migrant workers, you know, people from places like Henan or Anhui can really find state support for their migration. You know, a lot of those migrants would say that they'd been to Shanghai or to Beijing before as workers and, you know, found that they weren't really welcome or they had to really struggle to make it in those places. But they said in Xinjiang, you know, the police are here to support us and the cost of living is lower than Eastern China. And the, you know, income is not bad. It's easy to find work. And so they felt like they could really start their lives. So Xinjiang sort of promised them a new frontier, which is that's what Xinjiang means, that was available to them and that they're, you know, they were supported in a different way there. And so I'm talking a lot about Chinese concept of suzhi, which is a achieved quality or human capital, and how these migrants felt like they were, you know, achieving that to a certain degree in the Xinjiang space. And I'm thinking about, you know, how this compares to other kinds of capital accrual or suzhi in other places in China. And then at the same time, I'm thinking about how Uyghurs who are coming to the same city, to the same space, feel as though they're constantly blocked and how that their labor is not being valued in the same way. How they're, you know, always on the run from the police, being forced to leave. That the indigenous or yerlik, the native work that they carry with them into the city is not valued. And so that's just me sort of, you know, showing how this works. The next chapter, which is about dispossession, is focused on, you know, what happens in the village. So I'm actually going to the village. That's how the chapter starts. Really showing you how tight the policing is in those contexts and how limited opportunities are for Uyghur villagers because of the dynamics that have happened over the last two decades there. And so, you know, the city promises a space of anonymity and a space where they can, you know, make some money to find a better life. They're also being drawn into new kinds of cosmopolitanism by the technology, you know, thinking about the broader Muslim world. They're watching Iranian films. They're reading about what's happening in Istanbul, about the Arab Spring, stuff like that. And they're also getting involved in piety networks, Islamic teaching groups, Quranic study groups on WeChat. And so it's presented to them as a way of finding a contemporaneity, a way of finding a future through technology and through migration to the city. But I show at the end of the chapter that, you know, that's also turns out to be a false promise, that, you know, it actually by claiming an individual sort of persona online, they're exposing themselves to the state. And they're also severing or distancing themselves from the community support that they might otherwise have in the countryside. So, you know, it's talking about agency, but also processes of dispossession that are, you know, targeting that agency at the same time.
Mm-hmm. And those come into focus, I think, very clearly in a number of areas where you very deftly line up sort of parallel or cognate notions within Uyghur linguistic and cultural space, and then within settler Chinese, Han Chinese sort of linguistic and cultural space. This Suzhou idea has its own counterpart in Uyghur with this notion of Sapa, right? And also a sort of quality or a sort of aspirational, achieved sort of, I don't know, urbane subjectivity or something, but one that is not actually equivalent because of a lot of the, you know, limiting structures. One is not actually available ultimately. And I think it's those parallels that you draw between processes which look quite similar, which look quite universally part of a bigger Chinese story across the last 20, 30 years that are very distinctive in this, you know, ethno-racialized colonial capitalist frontier context. I think, you know, that's something that's very effective about what you discuss. But moving on into the latter part of the book, you kind of break down a few more, I suppose, granular strategies or practices that emerge in this very, very constrained context. And we've alluded already to friendship and the role of masculinity within that. But could you say a bit more about the role of friendship here between male Uyghur migrants to the city? Is it best seen, for example, as a functionalist response? Are these tight, close-knit friendships best viewed as coping mechanisms primarily, or how to understand their role within, you know, the very difficult circumstances?
Mm-hmm. Right. So, I mean, in some ways, they're amplified as a response to the situation that people find themselves in. So they are reactive, I suppose, to a certain extent. But the friendships that Uyghurs have come out of an older, you know, native tradition of friendship in village settings. Uyghurs have so many different words for friend. It's something that, you know, struck me as a Uyghur language learner. In some places like Khotan, they, you know, people typically end their sentences with the word friend or adash at the end of it when they're speaking to a friend. It's just something that, you know, is so emphasized in society. And some of that has to do with, you know, gender segregation that, you know, has a longer history in Uyghur society and has been amplified, I think, by the current situation. And so there's, you know, homosocial relations are an important part of Uyghur culture, maybe more so than some other societies. But I really wanted to zero in on a particular kind of friendship, a kind of friendship that they call a John Jigger Dost, which is someone who shares the same sort of life spirit or John, and also jigar, which is your liver organ. And so you're both kind of soulmates and also blood brothers, or you know, you're sharing the same liver. And it's just a kind of intimate friendship between men that I've never really observed close up, you know, anywhere before in my life. You know, what it means for these migrant men to the city is that it means that they share food every day, that they guard their friendships really closely. They're jealous of other people, other men. And like, I felt that myself, even though I wasn't like a you know, unofficial Jan Jigar Dost of anyone. But I was close friends with a lot of different groups of men, and you know, they didn't want to share me with other groups, and like they wanted me to meet with them, and if I didn't answer the phone when they called, like there was something wrong. There was, you know, just a lot of kind of intense intimacy in those friendships, and really what they were doing in the friendship space was telling stories about what had happened to them in the previous week or months, and they would, you know, often tell the same stories over and over again. It's a way of sort of narrating themselves as, you know, powerless people, but, you know, representing themselves as having a kind of authority or authorship of their own life story. And one of the ways that I kind of explored those friendships and tried to think about them as a sort of structural or conceptual category of Uyghur life was to use a novel by Perhat Dursun, which I co-translated with one of these friends, that is representing a singular man, Uyghur man, who comes to the city to try to find work and is always blocked. And this novel, you know, is something that I talked about or read with a bunch of these young men. And it became a sort of an object that they could respond to that sparked their own memories, their own ideas about what counts as a good life, why someone might be alienated, you know, how friendship is so important to feeling as though you're a successful person. So, you know, for me, like in the end, these friendships are a way of protecting each other, even as you're in a, you know, a shared vulnerability. And as a way of staying alive. I mean, these young men, or many of them were very depressed. They would talk about suicide and things like that, but how their friends would save them or keep them from committing suicide. So, you know, for me, it was a lesson in what friendship means, and, you know, how it can act as an anti-colonial strategy and relationship. So that's how I came to friendship. And, you know, it's one of the things I wanted to highlight as a way that, you know, Uyghurs respond. They live despite the circumstances that they find themselves in.
Right. And those are circumstances in which, as you also elaborate in many other places, lots of other practices of Uyghur social reproduction, the kind of sustainability, viability of Uyghur society is destroyed, is fundamentally interrupted. You know, the transmission of anything which in however woolly a way we might refer to as culture, of language, of everything is kind of interrupted. So, you know, the kind of reproduction in this context, as you've said, of maybe older, longstanding traditions of friendship, but also in a very particular contemporary context, it's a very powerful story you tell, and one which also resonates, I think, with broader anthropological practice. You point out here that anthropology itself, you know, can be reconceptualized in this sort of anti-colonial friendly way. And I think, you know, what you said about the sort of strikingness of coming upon these very warm male friendships in the field. I mean, I think anyone coming from a sort of cold Anglo-Saxon Protestant type cultural context, you know, not to be too self-confessional about it, is often struck at how turns out people are often very, very close in other cultural settings. So there is something broader about fieldwork among I guess perhaps Anglophone scholars to say there too. But in the final two chapters, you draw out further aspects of, you know, I guess, everyday practices, kind of low-level efforts to eke out certain forms of existence, to carve out autonomous space within these extreme circumstances. And among other things, you zoom in on this early experience you had, or at least I'm imagining drawing on your initial work with photographers and artists and so on, by focusing on a Han Chinese settler photographer, one of these old Xinjiang people whose work documents life in the outskirts of Urumqi. And through that and the subsequent chapter, you bring out another pair of these terms, these sort of binary of the Mangliu, the kind of wandering, vagabond Chinese, Han Chinese figure that Chen Ye, the photographer, identifies himself with. And then by contrast, Musapir, this term used in Uyghur for a traveler or a sort of mobile person. So if it's possible to sort of draw together those chapters and what you say in them, could you kind of tell us what light that pair of ideas sheds on the divergent experiences of settler, Han Chinese settler people in Xinjiang and Uyghur population, and I guess broadly what that says about whether there is any possibility at all for reconciliation, rapprochement, or solidarity, you know, on any level, however improbable.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, Chen Ye, this Han photographer, he grew up in a village just north of the city of Urumqi, and you came to the city to study, to go to college, but then couldn't find a job, and so he became a photographer. And he also had a Buddhist practice. He's a really interesting guy. He lived at a monastery for a while. Anyway, he was really intrigued by what he was observing in the informal settlements around Urumqi, where Uyghur migrants would, you know, try to eke out a living. And so he, you know, started to document their lives and built relationships with those people, and really developed a kind of practice of a minor politics, which is what I call it, sort of drawing on the work of Xu Meishi and a few others, which is a grassroots politics that, you know, is not about seeking a kind of formal recognition, but it's about solidarity and solidarity work. And you know, he did that through his practice, trying to help Uyghurs to navigate the bureaucracy of the city, but also by the way that he, you know, showed and through his work and through his practice, how Han people could respond to the situation in a way that wouldn't exacerbate the tensions that were there existing. So he became a kind of translator of Uyghur experiences for Han people. And so I really wanted to highlight his story because I think he's an exemplary figure. He's someone who I was drawn to because of his ethics. And I think he serves as a kind of model, the kind of solidarity that Han people can build and do build in this space. There's, you know, lots of Han people in Xinjiang and in China who are opposed to what the state is doing. And, you know, some of those people are the people that have leaked information about what's going on, often their capacity for resistance is pretty limited. And so it's more about, like, you know, getting information out for their neighbors, trying to get their neighbors out of the camps, those sorts of things. But I, you know, his story is important because it shows that there's fracture in the system, and that, you know, it's the system does not speak for all Han people. But, you know, when he claims a Mangliu position as a traveler, as a migrant worker, that's, you know, he self-identifies in that way. And, like, Mangliu is a term, you know, elsewhere in China that, you know, in the past was used in a derogatory way towards migrants. But then, you know, migrants started to claim it as their own and say, yes, we're Mangliu and we're proud of it. We're migrant workers and we're proud of it. And so, you know, he's claiming that term. And that's similar to the ways that Uyghur migrants talked about themselves as being musapir, which is a traveler in Uyghur language. But, you know, a traveler who's sort of seeking the existence of God. That's one of the ways that it's talked about in a sort of Sufi tradition, but also in a kind of, you know, it means homeless. It means being a refugee as well. Although there's another term for migrant. And so when they say musapir, they're being sort of poetic and, you know, cognizant of the sort of spiritual and other implications that are connected to it beyond the economic. And so I was really interested in how the Musapir form sort of mosque communities, because that's often how people sort of organize their life when they got to the city. And so they, build a kind of agency that supports each other, a kind of lateral agency. But they're also making themselves a target by being associated with the mosque and being associated with religious practice. For them, it's a lot less of a choice than it was for Qianye. Like Qianye could have gone back to his village and he could have been a farmer and it would have been fine. But like these people felt like they couldn't live their lives in the village. And so they came to the city to try to find work and more freedom. They felt less choice. I think in how they got to their Musapir position, but they also felt a sense of belonging, a sense of protection spiritually by claiming that identity. That's how I'm thinking about why people choose to move, and what kinds of communities are available to them when they move. And in the Xinjiang context, the Mongliu position is much better protected than the Musapir position. Most of those Musapir, already in 2015, 200,000-300,000 of them had been sent back to the villages. When I went in 2018, almost all of them were gone. There was just entire abandoned streets of people that have been sent back, and many of those people have ended up in the camps.
Right, and I mean, what you reveal there, I guess, as previously with this sort of hinge between Musapir versus Mongliu, is this notion that there are things that are to some extent translatable. The other thing that you point out in the final chapter, the family you focus on, is what's known as the family is known as a nail house in China, right? A dingzihu, which is the kind of final resistant single household, kind of often surrounded by demolished other buildings and with kind of encroaching new apartment blocks. You see this in a lot of places, but what you highlight there with this kind of terminological hinge, I suppose, is the very distinctive again. Experience of some of those broader dynamics within a Uyghur context. So thank you, Darren. I mean, there's an awful lot more that could be said about literally every aspect of this book. There's so much depth and detail and nuance in every chapter that we've really only scratched the surface. And you end, I should say, too, in your conclusion with a sort of final reflective account of your 2018 visit and seeing, as you've said, the places, the spaces, the people kind of gone. So it's a kind of damning, I guess, but moving final kind of coda there. Before we let you go, though, and thank you for appearing, I'll ask you what you're kind of working on next. You've already alluded to your translation of Per Hattorsson's The Back Streets, which is, I believe, imminent. But what else are you working on currently?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the Backstreets novel will be out from Columbia University Press in September. I have another book project that's looking more at state power and bureaucratic power more directly, less at economy, and more historical. That's thinking through the Mao period into the present. And it's really drawing a lot on police documents. So, part of what frames the first chapter, I had some access to this as I was writing, was the hundreds of thousands of internal police documents that were received by The Intercept and then given to me as an analyst to review. But there's just so much granular detail in these police documents that I felt like they really deserve a kind of book project. So I'll be doing that and also drawing on interviews with former detainees, people that have left the region since 2018 and are now in Kazakhstan and other places, to sort of piece together, how state power has been exercised and is being exercised in this space. That's a work in progress, and will probably be another year or two before we get anywhere closer to publication. I also have another project farther down the line that's focused on global China and infrastructure development in other places. So I want to think about how the tools of digital enclosure that were used in Xinjiang are being built in other places and how they affect people differently there, and try to sort of trouble the idea of, you know, authoritarian technology transfer and ideology transfer, that, you know, do these technologies bring and produce exactly the same kind of dynamics that we see in Xinjiang? And, you know, the answer, of course, is no, but they do produce other dynamics. And so I'm going to go to Kuala Lumpur and look at the way a smart city, safe city system there is affecting stateless populations, which include Uyghurs. There's a number of Uyghurs that live there, but also Rohingya folks who have fled from Myanmar. And so, you know, that's another place where I can think in a, you know, in an adjacent space that is Muslim majority and is democratic in some ways, about these technologies and, you know, how different, how similar are they to the ways that they're being used in China? And how much do they just sort of replicate the sort of policing surveillance systems that we see in European and North American contexts? And, you know, how do people navigate those kinds of surveillance systems? So it's a not an uplifting book or project, but I think, you know, it will give another sort of analytic for thinking about global China and thinking about the dynamics that I saw play out in Xinjiang. There is more hope than what we see in Xinjiang in the Kuala Lumpur case.
That's a relief to hear, I suppose. But anyway, both of those sound like fantastic compliments and supplements and expansions of this existing book, and as if any gaps needed filling in what you've already worked on, which, you know, of which there are not many. I think those will do a terrific job. Darren Beiler, though, thank you very much for joining us on the podcast today. It's been wonderful talking to you.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Listeners, thank you too, as ever, for listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. It's a podcast on the New Books Network, and it will be back with you again very soon. Goodbye.